T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
We have Dr. Scott Hardiman on with us. He's a physician at Gateway ENT and urgent specialists. And you can find out more about urgent specialists online at urgentspecialist.com. Dr. Hardiman, thanks for coming on with us again. It seems as though cases are on the rise and people are wondering if we've made a big mistake opening up. I was wondering what you thought about that.
Well, it's kind of interesting in Missouri. I think today is the day that we start to expand our capacity at restaurants and other places from 25% to 50%, and that's in the midst of, the case numbers increasing sort of across the country. So I don't think it's a mistake. I think this is just a natural ebb and flow of what you're going to see in isolated pockets. You know, we had our peak here in St. Louis area was quite a while back, and we continue to have steady declines in hospitalizations and deaths. And overall are doing really well, I think largely due to some of the mitigation procedures that have been put in place. But, I think we're on the right track, at least here. And I think nationally things, while there's a spike in cases in various places, they're fairly isolated in states. And it's not to be unexpected, just given how people are out and about a little bit more. And we're going to see probably more of those cases over time. But following different metrics, meaning looking at hospitalizations, ICU admissions, and deaths associated with the virus, it seems like those numbers are holding steady or continuing to decline in most areas in the country at this point still.
Dr. Hardiman, is there anything to attribute the rise in cases to specifically? I mean, does it have to do with reopening the economy? Is it protests? Is it events? Is there anything you can point to, or is it rise in testing, all of these things together?
Yeah, I think to be honest, it's probably all of those things. I don't know that anyone could be able to put their finger on any one of those particular issues. I can just speak from the perspective of being involved with seeing a lot of tests and interpreting them, is that the vast majority of the positive cases, which are not huge numbers that we're seeing, at least through the urgent care, are completely asymptomatic individuals or family members of someone who had the virus a while back. And so I think there's a lot of reasons. It stands to make sense that as people become more exposed to one another, that with any respiratory illness or something that's communicable, you're going to see that kind of move and transition through. I think Dr. Fauci, I guess it was it Friday, I think they held a press conference, and they were talking about how the younger population is out and about and, expected to start to see increases in numbers like that as well. There's a lot of factors that come into play, but I'm not personally overly surprised by this. I don't think it's all gloom and doom. I think there's a natural tendency to get spooked whenever we hear increasing case numbers or apocalyptic scenarios in Houston and this and that. But when you really drill down past those initial headline numbers and realize that deaths are not rapidly increasing in correlation to that, and hospitalizations are actually pretty low overall based upon the number of positive cases, that should be reassuring that the severity of the illness right now, at least in the population that we're seeing get positive tests, is obviously pretty low. The vast majority of people, like we talked about, really don't have a whole lot of symptoms with these. And you could make that next sort of mental jump to the point, say 10 to 14 days from now, and say, okay, well, if we're going to follow hospitalizations or ICU admits or God forbid deaths, will we see those numbers starting to tick up over the course of the next couple of weeks? Because the point that they made last week in the press conference was be cognizant of your behaviors and activities in the younger population so you can continue to protect those that are most vulnerable. And that's absolutely important. That's what we've been talking about here. But we'll be interesting to see if we have an increase in hospitalizations or ICU admissions over the course of the next 7 to 14 days or so, which would be the timeline that kind of makes sense based upon exposures and what have you. And I guess my prediction would be probably not on a global scale. but we'll see how it all plays out.
We're speaking with Dr. Scott Hardiman, a physician at Gateway ENT and urgent specialist, online at urgentspecialist.com. And if you would like to ask the doctor a question, you can get onto our Facebook Live right now and send your comment in here, and we will bring it into the conversation. You can do the same thing if you're watching us on our Annie Fry YouTube page. So go ahead and submit your comment there, and we'll ask the doctor. You mentioned the death rate, and I don't want to glaze over this because, to me, there's two things that really matter. The amount of cases that we're going to show are obviously going to go up, A, when we open up, and B, when we're doing more testing. And I likened this earlier, I guess it was last week. Sometimes if you're trying to lose weight, or if you're feeling like, I just called it a fat day or whatever, you may choose not to step on the scale that day, but the scale is going to say what the scale is going to say. You're going to weigh what you're going to weigh, whether you look at the scale or not, and then maybe you make the adjustments the rest of the week to get back into your norm. The amount of cases that are out there right now, the amount of people who have been exposed to this, who have contracted this, it is what it is. Testing is just a measurement of whatever is actually the truth that is out there. But when you look at how we are managing the situation in hospitals, and you look at the death rate, how many people are succumbing to this, those are the numbers that we can look at right now that we know, as opposed to 3 months ago, we were looking at numbers that people were predicting. Can you kind of explain Correct. To all the people listening right now where you focus in, where you key in on, to measure the severity of where we are right now with the coronavirus?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So it was all modeling before, and now we're really looking back at data. So we know which groups of individuals, or populations, I should say, tend to have the highest mortality rate with that. The CDC has even adjusted their death percentage down to, you know, originally we were talking 4 and 5%, with their 10% other places. Now it's at 0.4%. which is, you know, broken down from birth to older age individuals, and most of that is in folks that are over 65 years of age or even older than that. So it really isn't until about 50 to 55 that the numbers really change, because the probability of dying from this, of if you're 35 years old or less, is 0.0005%. So it's very low in the grand scheme of things. They have a way higher chance of dying of some other issues. So where we are in the grand scheme of things, the testing now is we're starting to see that open up and see more and more people positive. But as we said, it seems as if that's a normal predictor to see out there. And you're right, it's an evolving thing, meaning that the testing and what we're doing today, there'll be big swings from one day to the next if the labs don't report all tests performed or all positive results performed or what have you. But the numbers, the statistics that I really tend to look at overall are less concerning about positive cases, although I get why the epidemiologist would be concerned about will that translate into more admissions, et cetera. But I really focus in on hospitalizations, ICU admissions, and deaths. And then, of course, not just hospitalizations, but average length of stay for hospitals. So back, you know, when this was really kind of ramping up and we were seeing the older population get sick, those that were in nursing homes and other places, the length of stay was really long, like weeks on end. And now I think nationwide, if I'm not mistaken, I think the average length of stay then the people are testing positive now about 1.5 days. So it would indicate that the severity of the illness, certainly in younger individuals, is just nowhere near what it is in older folks as well. So, it's hard because you have to be able to open up society and move things forward. We can't keep this shut down forever. You can't stop nature from kind of running its course to some degree. But we know who to protect now. We know the individuals that tend to be hit hardest in this. And that's will be sort of an interesting scenario to see play out over the next couple of weeks, as I mentioned earlier, whether or not we'll see an increase in those other markers of hospitalizations, length of stay, ICU admissions, et cetera.
We're speaking with Dr. Scott Hardiman, physician at Gateway ENT and urgent specialists, about everything going on with coronavirus. If you have a question, feel free to ask it online. One of those comes from Christopher, Dr. Hardiman. He says, has it been long enough to see antibody tests starting to trail off? I think we talked about this a couple years ago. Is there a maximum to the antibody test? Like, does it expire after a couple months?
To your circulating antibody, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, that, you know, in the past 7 to 10 days, those headlines have been popping up out there. I've had a couple of cases that I'm aware of that we were able to track them quantitatively over the course of over several months, and those numbers will drop a little bit. But I think the jury's probably still out a little bit on whether or not this has any long-term effect. And again, just to kind of clarify that, there's not just antibodies to that, but whether or not those are neutralizing antibodies that can actually protect you against that. And a lot of viruses, they tend to wear off over a period of time. But there's other forms that we focus a lot, in, at least in the adult population, on the antibody response to that. But we have other aspects of our immune system, the T-cell immunity that has different capacity to kill virus and to neutralize those as well, which is one of the reasons why in the pediatric population, it seems like children really don't harbor as much virus or not quite the vectors that they were once thought before, is that their innate immune system tends to deactivate that. And just within the past week or so, there's been more and more talk about T-cell immunity versus just those antibody levels throughout there. It's not necessarily a measurable response that you can see, which the antibodies make that nice because we all want to, you know, put a bow on this stuff and say this makes sense that way or this way. But there are other forms of immunity. So we'll see over time if the antibody levels continue to fall. But if they don't fall, will they be neutralizing antibodies, at least to protect people for 3, 4, 6 months out? That's a, and that's a reasonable period of time to think that antibody levels will help to prevent a reoccurrence of infection or redeveloping of symptoms.
Doctor, I want to ask you one question here before we take a break, and I encourage people to continue to start sending these questions on our Facebook and our YouTube Live. Betsy says, how is it we need a flu shot yearly, but they are stating vaccine for COVID? What's the difference between the flu shot that we do get every year and the conversation, the semantics behind saying, you know, we need to get a vaccine before we can fully suggest that we've beaten this thing?
Well, the flu vaccine is a little different in that the immunity sort of conferred from that doesn't have a long-lasting effect, but also the flu virus tends to have different strains of that. So they're making predictions of next year's influenza season now or a little while ago, and we're sort of developing the vaccines around that so that we have immunity to that. So, and you know, some years they'll say, well, we kind of missed on a strain. It's less protective this year versus that year. It just depends on the prediction that was done. With coronavirus, there most of the vaccines that are being looked at or developed now are the sort of new concept of these mRNA vaccines, and it's going to be there's not much experience with that. They're subsequently, or I guess at the same time, simultaneously doing animal studies and human studies on the stability of these vaccines going forward. The hope is that it's like some other childhood illnesses, that you get a sequence of shots or so and that your immunity lasts for a long time. But there's examples of that, that vaccines don't necessarily have lifelong effect. But if you can buy some time of a year or so and break that chain of transmission, then the disease just tends to burn itself out at that point, or will have much less severe seasonal variations to it, which is, I think, where the theory is that we might see this ebb and flow a bit. But as we creep towards vaccination, or could possibly creep towards herd immunity, with if enough people were exposed or infected, it would kind of break that transmission chain.
All right. Well, Dr. Hardiman, hold on the line. We're going to get back to you. We've
sure.
got some questions that are lining up here. Please send them in on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Annie Fry Show. You can comment there, and we will ask the doctor, as well as the Annie Fry YouTube page. Send in your comment and get the answer directly from a medical professional, Dr. Scott Hardiman, who is on with us right now. We're going to be back in just a minute with more on the latest COVID news that you need to know. Back in a second. So we have Dr. Scott Hardiman on with us right now. He is an ENT at Gateway ENT, also urgent specialist, where I believe you can go get a coronavirus test done. Is that correct, doctor?
That's correct, yeah. That's all the different testing methods are available, from antibodies to antigen testing to PCR testing. Mm-hmm.
Can you kind of explain to me, if somebody is going to come to urgent specialists and get a COVID test, maybe they need to get one to go back to work, maybe they don't, they just want to see if they're positive because they got a sniffle or something. What is that experience like?
So the testing, there's largely what gets done is testing that's either PCR driven through a nasal swab or saliva. Those are the molecular tests for the virus itself. And then the antigen test available too, which is a point of care test. So there are some rapid PCR tests that are out there and available. There's some questionable levels of accuracy to that with any of these tests, but certainly with the rapid PCR testing availability. The antigen test is also done off of a nasal swab too, but that takes about 15 minutes to do. So it's a meaning for to run the whole test. The actual swab takes literally 2 seconds or so to take a nasal swab, and then they put it in the analyzer and run that, and they give results very quickly as a result of that. When people come back and forth to work, it's really interesting, because this is just fascinating to talk about all the time, what's the right answer to every scenario. So You're seeing more and more now people talk about doing combinations of antibody testing in conjunction with PCR antigen testing to really get a sense of where they are, because some of these tests could be positive in someone in a delayed fashion for quite some time because the tests don't necessarily identify live virus. And this, I think, is important to remember because we're testing people who essentially have less or no symptoms. So preoperative testing or people who just want to know, hey, do I have it? Going to family reunion, doing something they sort of see. You test for this. Let's say you get a positive test in one of these individuals, but they have zero symptoms, no exposures whatsoever. It's conceivable that they may have had the virus a while ago and you're still seeing some viral particles that are turning up positive. And that's where then testing antibodies can give you a little clearer picture of what it is. So nothing's perfect. You know, every case is a little different, and you try and just a negative test is a negative test that day at that time. That doesn't mean you can't be exposed to it at some point in the future and get it. So it's a constant evolution of back and forth trying to interpret the data and scenario based upon the patient's overall health picture.
So I called one of the urgent cares that was right next to me, and I was also discussing with one of our mutual friends about how quickly urgent specialists can turn around the results. Some urgent cares locations are saying 2 to 5 days. You go get the test done, and your results will come back in 2 to 5 days. Is that the case at urgent specialists, or is it quicker than that?
So the antigen test that's done, which is on par and FDA approved emergency use authorization for COVID testing and a rapid response, is a point of care test. It takes 15 minutes from start to finish to do that. PCR testing, or the polymerase chain reaction, or other molecular tests that's done, it's rare that any urgent care facility would have a true PCR machine. Those are big data and lab-driven machines. So most are being sent out to labs. Usually it's anywhere from, say, 24 to 48 hours, in some cases a little bit longer. The hospitals have labs, and the large diagnostic centers do, and they will take those tests in and kind of put them in the queue and do that. The rapid test that was talked about, I guess this goes back a month or so ago when the virus made its way inside the West Wing, was the Abbott machine test, which is a rapid PCR test that works off of a slightly different technology than amplifying the genome like a true PCR test does. And it's, you know, its accuracy was questioned then and published out that it was about 50% accurate, which isn't overly comforting, that there's a 50-50 chance that the test is going to be inaccurate. And then it kind of died out. Abbott said that, you know, our machine is more accurate than that. And then in the past week or so, there's been more evidence that it's perhaps not quite as accurate. So
The PCR test that you're talking about, the difference between, you know, is that the antibody test or is that the actual,
That's an actual COVID test. So basically the tests break down to either COVID tests or antibody tests. The antibodies are the antibodies. It's a blood draw or finger stick test. The COVID tests themselves are both essentially considered molecular tests, and they're either a PCR test looking for the viral genetic makeup or an antigen test looking at the protein on the surface of the virus itself, both identifying true virus versus just your immune response to that.
Dr. Hardiman, we've got some questions coming in online. Joseph wanted to ask if this surge was inevitable. I don't know if you've seen graphs of other nations. It seems like the cases kind of peaked and then went back down. Ours have peaked and then kind of gone back up again. So in light of that, was this destined to happen?
I think so. I think my view of this is that the places that are seeing peaks or spikes or surges, depending on how we look at it, it's our areas that haven't really seen big numbers before. So it's kind of moving its way through in different parts of the country. You know, in states like New York, they're continuing to have good numbers there. And so Florida kind of ebbs and flows a little bit. But again, it's a younger population that we're seeing test more positive now and not necessarily being sick with that. So I think it's pretty predictable. I would say it's not uncommon to see this with any respiratory pathogen or illness based upon how infectious this is thought to be, that you're going to see a little ebb and flow. But if we continue to see, you know, exposure in the community, but admissions and real severe cases continue to decline, that's probably the key take-home point.
I want to ask you Julie's question here. She said, we kind of covered this earlier, but I want to give you another opportunity to kind of sum up. What's the most important stat to follow? Number of people yesterday, deaths as a percentage of tested, number of hospitalizations, ICU bed availability. Doctor, what's the most important stat that people should be following?
Well, they're all probably important, but I would not get caught up in just the daily, here's a swing this direction or that direction, you know, and just that a lot of that just has to do with timing of reporting or other things that pop up from time to time. Towards the end of the week, sometimes the labs don't release data, then they do a data dump on Saturday or Monday, and it makes it look like there's a massive increase in cases, or the other direction. I think following the rolling averages, the trends in general, again, the percentage of people still, at least in our part of the country, in St. Louis area in particular, testing positive based on total number of tests is down around 5.7 or so percent right now. So that kind of gives you an indicator of where we are, that there's, you know, 94% chance or so that if you go get tested, that you're probably going to be negative when that happens. But I think probably the most important thing, if you just want to take the 60,000-foot view of this, is keep an eye on the overall number of cases and then look at the number of hospitalizations. And then from hospitalizations, you can sort of infer from that severity based upon length of hospital stay or number of ICU admissions or deaths associated with that. And the death number is still low. I think the number from Worldometer, which is a great source to follow these statistics every day, was 120 deaths reported in the past 24 hours or so in the United States, which is not nothing, but there's a lot of other reasons that people pass away in this country that are far exceeding that at this point too. And looking at the overall impact on the economy and healthcare in general, is that non-COVID patients suffer when we shut things down. So it has to be a really targeted approach and keeping a close eye on it, not be quite so reactionary to every little blip here or there. And we'll see in 7 to 10 days. I mean, this has been really fascinating week by week to just watch this evolve and see where we are.
Dr. Scott Hardiman, physician at Gateway ENT and urgent specialist on the phone with us. Doctor, what about a vaccine update? And then Bobby online also wants to ask, you know, in your medical opinion, is a vaccine something that should be mandatory?
Oh, that's a slippery slope, isn't it?
Sure it is.
So vaccine update, not a whole lot published at this point in time. There's obviously intense research. I think there's over 100 different vaccine trials going on right now. As I mentioned briefly earlier, it seems like most is focusing in on these new mRNA vaccines. There's some technical issues with that and how stable those vaccines are. They're more expensive than the traditional style of vaccine. Should it be mandatory? Boy, maybe I'll tackle that question in 2 or 3 months when we see what's really going on. That's a civil liberties issue that comes down to it. And I think for seasonal flu influenza, people feel very strongly about not wanting to take it or take it. I have a feeling that when this vaccine comes out, depending on where we are in the disease progression, it's probably going to be mandatory, especially if you're going into healthcare environments or nursing homes or places with direct patient care or where you could potentially expose other people to that. I'll just comment real quickly, though, too. Right before the break, we kind of talked about some immune-related issues to that. So, we're focusing a lot of our attention on vaccines, which generate an antibody response to this, which are obviously a key part of the immune system. We talk a lot about antibodies, but the other side of that T cell immunity, there's different ways that works too. So in most patients, a large population, 70-80% of people also have a really robust T cell immune response, which means there's two types. There's T helper cells, which basically recognize a virus and present that to your B cells, which are the things that make the antibodies that help fight off infection and prevent it from getting access to your body. But there's also killer T cells that just nuke a virus when it gets into a cell and just kill those things off. And it seems like there's a pretty robust T cell immune response to that, but they may not necessarily show, if you just draw antibodies on them, you may not necessarily see that as you sneak away from the infection, get further and further out from that. The hope is that when you get exposed to it, again, if you do in the community, that your body can recognize that and very rapidly ramp up a response to it. That's I think, going to be a real focus. It really has gained a lot of momentum in the past 3 to 4 weeks or so of recognizing the role of the T cell immunity in fighting off this infection too, and perhaps some exposure from previous coronavirus that may confer a little bit of recognizable antibody response if you become in contact with the SARS-CoV coronavirus.
One last question before I let you go, and this is kind of my own question paired with a couple that I've seen here coming in on the comments on Facebook Live and our Annie Fry YouTube Live, is when we are looking at numbers now, it seems to me that the goalposts have kind of moved. So the way that we are measuring things now, is that the same way we were measuring things 2 months ago when we were, I know a lot of hospitals, there's a lot of criticism about the way hospitals would, if you tested positive and you were in a car accident and died from a car accident, you tested positive, that could still be classified as a COVID death because of funding that the hospital would get. by virtue of the numbers of COVID deaths that they have. So are we comparing, yeah. If you're looking at the progress over time, is that even a little bit subjective to the way these numbers have been measured over the course of the last 5-6 months?
I think so. You can make statistics say anything you want, right? It just depends on how you dice up the numbers. But I think there's, in most states, there's a little bit of recalculation going on as far as the death rate and cases that perhaps died with COVID versus die of COVID. So we may see that adjust a little bit. There's quite a few states in the union that are reporting cases, positive rates, positive numbers based upon positive tests when they happen. So, you know, for instance, if you test positive and then you get treated and you have to have two negative tests before you get out of the hospital or go back to work, and you test positive on one of those again, they'll report that as a positive test again. So I think everyone's trying to feel their way through that. In the purest sense, you would think you're either positive or you're negative. If you test positive, you get counted as positive one time, mm-hmm. and the numbers go forward from there. They're also now counting antibody tests and those positive tests as well. And so I think in Missouri, it's 3.8% of people were testing positive for antibodies. Well, those are folks that very likely had this months ago, at least weeks ago at this point. And so are they at risk of infecting other people in the population? I would say the short answer to that is probably no. So that's really where the rubber meets the road on this, is the transmissibility and trying to keep people from getting really sick or dying from this. I just don't think you can necessarily just, you know, will this thing out of existence. And so we just have to be cognizant of monitoring that and trying to protect those most vulnerable out there.
Dr. Hardeman, it's always a pleasure to get these straight answers from you. And I want to encourage people, if you were thinking about getting one of these tests, please go to urgentspecialist.com and find out more about them. It's the best place you can go to get it. I think I'm going to go get tested, and I'm going to make the drive over to Urgent Specialist because they are the best in urgent care in the business. Dr. Hardeman, we'll talk to you again next week. Thank you so much.
Thank you all very much. Have a good day.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.